Welcome to The Scrub Life, a podcast for and about the incredible profession of surgical technology. I'm Chris Blevins, and our mission at The Scrub Life is to educate the public about surgical technology. Each episode dives into the wonderful world of surgery, where we inform and hopefully entertain our listeners while interviewing amazing individuals within the field and presenting the hot topics everyone wants to know more about. We've now partnered with the Association of Surgical Technologists to help us expand our conversations, bolster our engagement, and bring further awareness to the surgical technology profession. CSTs are an integral part of the sterile team that cares for patients in the operating room. Learn more about this exciting field, the immense effort that goes into educating future CSTs, and how you too can become a ninja of the OR. Now, without further ado, here's the latest episode of the Scrub Life Podcast. Hey, Scrub Lifers. This episode hits near and dear to my heart. I am a military wife. I have a military family. We've definitely had our share of ups and downs. And this episode features Daniel Carlton, one of our military veterans, who is also a wounded warrior, but so much more than that. So there are a few moments in this episode where the audio isn't perfect. Dina was battling weather coming in Texas, but even those grainy parts are so incredibly worth your time and are valuable. So I hope you truly find something in this episode that makes you laugh, something that makes you cry, something that makes you appreciate your life as an American citizen, and also something that motivates you to continue to do everything that you can to serve others, because I know Daniel has definitely motivated me to do such. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Scrub Life. I want to introduce my very special guest, Daniel Carlton. Daniel's story is amazing, and he works with a bunch of his colleagues for a surgical instrument company, and I just can't wait for you all to hear how he got to the place he is now. So without further ado, Daniel, welcome to The Scrub Life, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Chris, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you and I have spoken before, and we have very similar backgrounds in the fact that you and I both are members of military families. And so, you know, my husband was in the Air Force, so I think you and I can relate on so many different levels. But will you just start out by telling me a little bit about your service, how long you were in, and anything you want to share on that aspect?
Of course. Yeah, thanks. And thanks to your family for the service to the country. Yeah, so I joined the Army in 1999, straight out of high school. And I thought it would just be a couple years, you know, do an enlistment and kind of move on with life. But I found it to be really enjoyable, had a great time. Took me down some pretty interesting choices that I made in life. You know, I tried out for Special Forces to be a Green Beret in the Army, and I made it. And then once I got into the Special Operations community, you know, I knew that's where I wanted to be. So I spent most of my time in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Latin America, just traveling the world in service for our country, and it was fantastic.
What was the process like for getting into Special Forces? I think a lot of it has been maybe, I think people think of Hollywood and the way that it's portrayed in the movies. Like all of us in surgery, you know, we don't think that the movies ever get it right. What's your experience like seeing kind of your journey on film? Do they ever get it right there either?
I think they get a little bit right. I mean, obviously it's pretty unique thing. You see, you know, Navy SEALs and Army Rangers and Army Green Berets more on TV than it probably any other time before in history, with the global war on terror, you know, like the impact that those units, you know, in Air Force Special Operations, the impact that they've had on the GWAT. So it's a pretty grueling process. It's about a 2-year-long pipeline and you know, 18 months to 2 years. So it just depends on your specialty, your language that you learn and things like that. So yeah, Hollywood does get it right a little bit to some degree, but I think some of it is intentionally Hollywood fictionalized a little bit, you know, you see. Yeah. So, but there's a lot of it that is accurate, and it's hard to watch movies sometimes or a TV show where you're like, that's not real. That's, you know, that's not how it goes. So it's funny at times. And I think that's why when you get together with veteran buddies and you watch a movie, like it turns into a bit of a disaster because immediately you start critiquing and you're like, come, this ain't even real. You know, it's not even close. But, you know, to the average person, you know, the civilian who hasn't served, you know, they're hooked, right? They're like, you guys did all this, you know, and all that. So it's pretty funny.
Well, so what made you, or I guess what drew you to serving? What was it about Special Forces, I think, that kind of lit your fire?
At the time, I was in Kosovo about year 2000, and Special Forces wasn't really mainstream as it is today, the special operations. And I was a private, and I remember seeing these guys go out in the middle of the night, didn't know anything about these guys. You know, they kept to themselves. It was intriguing to me of kind of what they do, who they are, and it's very mysterious. Had no idea at all about anything in that realm. So the more I read about it, the more I became intrigued, and I was hooked, and it's very difficult. And I said, well, I'm going to give it a try. And if I tried, you know, I don't make it, at least I tried. Because I think that's where a lot of people are afraid to take challenges. You know, they want to do something that's kind of mysterious. It's very demanding. And they're intimidated by that. So I think for me, I think that was by not trying and having a regret, you know, of getting out of the military and saying, man, I wish I would have tried that at least. You know, like that to me would have been a regret that I wouldn't have been happy with. So, you know, I trained the best I could. And I was like, you know what, let's sign up for the selection course and give it a shot. And then it's really up to the cadre, because you don't know what they're looking for in a person, the qualities. And so, you know, I just did my best. I got selected and I went on to become a Special Forces Engineer Sergeant, an explosives guy. So demolitions is where I spent the bulk of my career on the Special Forces A team.
So what does a demolition specialist work on? I know it's explosives, but are you creating explosives or are you seeking them out and disarming them, or is it a little bit of both?
It's a lot of both. So you're responsible as a demo man, you know, demo guy, you're responsible for prepping and employing explosives, both conventional and the homemade explosive types, and then also countering, you know, what we find on the battlefield today. So the IEDs, the improvised explosive device that the enemy was putting all over Afghanistan, Iraq, and in these places. So, you know, we'd find an IED on the road. Of course, they would call me up and I'd go out there and kind of figure out what's going on there and kind of what's the best way to render it safe and take care of it so we can continue the mission safely.
So we talk a lot, and I think the physical demands of your career field are pretty well known. But in order to grasp all of the different and complex processes for explosives, that takes a lot of intelligence too. And I would imagine it takes a lot of training and book work. What was that like? Were you in a classroom as much as you were on an obstacle course or out in the field?
Yes. Once you get to the phase of the engineer course, it really takes a turn. So it becomes very academic. There's a lot of things that could go wrong when you get a lot of, you know, anyone who's never been around explosives and then you kind of throw them into the mix. They do a really fantastic job of getting folks prepared, oriented to the, you know, explosives 101, you know, demolitions 101. And then you start taking those classroom lessons and applying them at a range somewhere at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And then you're doing the practical exercises and you just, it's kind of just over and over and over until guys are comfortable and you're passing the requirements, and there's a lot of tests that you have to kind of overcome. And they do a really good job of making sure guys are locked in and fully understand that the hazards of that profession, because it's it can get very dangerous really quick. So.
Yeah. Well, and not that there's really any comparison between the operating room and what you all did downrange, but you know, when I teach my students how to handle scalpels and how to handle suture, and all of these things are incredibly sharp. And we practice with the real thing from day one, because you never want them to have that like false sense of security. I would imagine in that way, like you train as real world as you possibly can, right?
It's exactly, there's a lot of similarities there. You teach them what right looks like. You get them comfortable in an uncomfortable environment, whether in an OR, at a demo range. You teach them what those hazards are and what it means to be safe. There's a lot of similarities there, actually.
Yeah. You know, I think we both also, just to make another kind of correlation, we work under pressure all the time. I'm a trauma scrub, so my patients were actively trying to die on me from the moment they got on my table. And you have to learn those skills to how to focus on what you're doing and handle the pressure while also keeping your cool, because, you know, we are handling sharp objects. And in that way, you know, of course, you all are handling explosives that could go off at any minute. You know, how did you learn those skills to be calm under pressure?
That's a great question. I don't know. It's just one of those things. I think it starts at the individual level. Mm-hmm. For instance, volunteering or applying to be a part of a career field that's pretty unique, whether that's in the OR, in the ER, or whatever that is, or on an A team in special forces, you have to automatically assume that you're going to be put into some pretty unusual, uncomfortable circumstances or situations. And so from there, it's really up to the selection committee at Special Forces Selection Course. You know, they know what they're looking for in a person, those traits. And so as you do these events where they're evaluating and they're assessing constantly, they know what a person should or shouldn't be doing. And yeah. And not every time that person, that candidate, is going to pass, right? Like they're not going to meet the standards, but they can see through their assessment, like, okay, this guy has what we're looking for. Even though he may have missed the criteria here, or he didn't do as well as we would like them to here, that person can be trained. But yeah, it's that uniqueness that we look for, that we need out there on the force, that is going to benefit the regiment, the Special Forces Regiment. So, you know, once you get through there, it's really a matter of repetition, of being comfortable in an uncomfortable situation. You know, in that case, when I've seen an OR in training, how people, you know, their introduction to a case in OR or handling instruments, you can tell the veterans that have been around, they know exactly what to do because of their comfort level. And then you get the new folks who are kind of a little more timid, right? But it's through mentorship and the experience that you train that the next generation of techs or Green Berets or whatever that is, that is that community, whether you're an educator, you know, taking that the education and experience to the next generation of folks and getting them dialed in to serve.
Yeah, we talk a lot about muscle memory, like practicing perfectly, because there are going to be times where adrenaline kicks and you can't rely on the signals that your brain is sending you. So you have to be able to rely on your physical body just going through the motions and knowing what comes next. Kind of like when you drive a car, there are moments where you're tired but your body knows, you know, how to get home, even when your brain exactly is kind of out. And so muscle memory, I would think, plays in steady hands.
Exactly. I mean, the human body is an incredible thing, you know, machine or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's just what people are capable of in these situations. When you have a patient, they bring a patient in, for instance, and someone who's in bad shape, that surgeon or your teammates are relying on you to really do your job proficiently. There's a lot of things that go on there, a lot of adrenaline, a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah. The muscle memory absolutely just, it kicks in.
So you've talked a lot about teamwork and about, you know, precepting and mentoring the next generation. What was your advice for the new guy coming onto the team who was nervous, who didn't feel like they were at the level that you all needed them to be at? What was your approach to being a mentor?
Oh, that's a good question. Every time we'd get a new team guy in, you, it's funny because they're different personalities. Everyone's a type A personality there, but to the, what degree that type A is, you know, varies. You get guys who would come in and think they knew what they're doing. And so immediately you just kind of slap that guy around a little bit and say, hey man, like you need to sit down and listen and learn, because being on an A team is not like coming from a conventional unit, like a regular Army unit. It's a lot different because we could call on you tomorrow by yourself to go carry out some mission in a foreign country and that's it. Or, you know, you could go be deployed with a team. So it's very unusual, and the environment is just unlike any other. And then you have the new guy that shows up who shows up and he says, hey, I'm here to do my part. I'm here to listen and learn. I know nothing. And you're like, that's a great place to start. You just feel out the personality. It's like any other job. You learn that person's personality and kind of what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are, and just get them integrated to the team is the best way you can, because, you know, the missions come down, people are sent orders, you know, maybe one guy by himself or maybe six guys, you know, in a foreign country somewhere. So we got to be ready for anything. And that in itself is a pretty large order. So it's drinking through a fire hose.
I love that analogy. I think that getting to be a military wife, there, you know, there's a lot that my husband would never tell me and continues to not tell me, even in retirement. But I know that it's not always go, go, go. There are moments where you can breathe. And I would think that it is critical to be able to kind of decelerate and blow off steam or remove that stress so that you can re-energize for the next thing. What did you guys do in order to kind of try to relax and break that cortisol chain before the next mission?
Yeah, it's a very demanding lifestyle, being in special operations, and that's with any branch of service. To be honest with you, I didn't have a lot of time. It was either a pre-mission train up where you're getting ready to go on a mission, and then they would pull you off to a school somewhere, and then you'd go to an advanced demo course or high altitude parachuting course or ranger school. Then you come back, you may have like a week off, 2 weeks off, and then you're out the door going somewhere for anywhere from 30 days to 90 days to 9 months. So I think it's really, and everyone's different. You know, for me, it was just family time. It was, my wife gives me a hard time because it was like vacation, because, you know, I would show up, go have a great time, and then rile up the kids and really spoil them. And then I'd be gone, you know, 2 weeks later, and then she'd have to kind of clean up the holiday mess or the vacation mess,
the,
you
know, aftermath.
Aftermath. And then I was gone.
I can relate to your wife so much because, you know, we also have kids, and yeah, when dad came home, it was a big vacation. It was party time. It was, yeah, you can have donuts every morning and sure, we can order pizza every night, and, you know, and you get them sugared and carved up and all excited, and then you leave, and then we have to be the bad guy that's like, nope, there really is a bedtime.
Yep, it's exactly what it is. You know, and my wife is a West Point graduate. She deployed to Iraq twice, you know, so she kind of got it. But, yeah. You know, as much as I was away, you know, we really enjoyed our time together as much as we could. But of course, you know, she's like, well, looks like it's time for me to start dealing with the after party stuff, you know, getting back in the routine.
So. Be the bad guy. Yeah. I love it. I wanted to kind of talk to you about your experiences downrange and maybe some of the darker times, but war is a travesty and it can bring out the evil in our humanity. And you witnessed a lot of that firsthand. And then you also were, you know, a victim of that. What can you share about that experience downrange and the aftermath from it?
Yeah, you're right. War will bring out the best of people, but it also brings out the worst in people. You see humanity at its best and at its worst. And I pretty much since 2003 was in and out of war zones across the Middle East and Southwest Asia, and doing some things in Central and South America and the Caribbean. That was pretty eye-opening as well. So spent years in a combat zone. mostly in Afghanistan. A couple common workplace injuries, I guess. You know, I had gotten shot on a patrol in 2008 in Afghanistan. I lost my leg to an IED in 2012 in Afghanistan, both in Kandahar. They weren't fans of me there, so they tried to take me out of the game, but they tried, but it didn't work, so I'm still here. So,
yeah, they did.
But yeah, it's really a fascinating experience to be. I mean, war is often just a lot of boredom mixed in with some pretty intense moments. It's quite an experience, and it's not a good experience, but you know, the folks, so there's some great people in all of those places that need help. But there's also some people over there that in all of those places that probably need to be, you know, sent away somewhere and kind of handled. So, and to be a part of a special operations unit that was thrust in the front lines and helping some of the best people on the planet or taking care of some of the worst people on the planet it's a pretty unique experience.
Sure. So I know that you were an explosive guy, but you have to have medical training in order to go downrange because you or your comrades could need help at any moment. What was that like getting thrust into medicine or combat triage 101?
Yeah, it's a little uncomfortable for me. You know, like I was doing the Special Forces Medical Sergeant course. It's a year long, and about 6 months into it, you know, I was like, man, I just didn't have confidence. It was new, like combat medicine, combat trauma medicine was new to me. I've done some basic courses and stuff like that, but I never really put it together until you could be responsible for looking in someone's eyes and everything that's going in that person's eyes. He's looking at you and relying on you to keep him alive. And to me, I was like, man, that's a pretty heavy task. And yeah. I wasn't ready for it. I didn't want to carry on with that course because that's a big burden. And my hat's off to all the medical people, but you know, paramedics or first responders or doctors or surgeons who deal with that every single day, because it's a heavy thing to carry, you know. And you see it in war, things happen so fast. You see all of a sudden guys are together, and the next thing you know, you're looking at pieces of a guy, and the guy's still alive, and you're trying to do what you can, and that adrenaline kicks in, and there's combat happening. You're receiving gunshot fire, and you're trying to pull this guy to safety and patch him up. So, man, it's a really intense thing. And combat field medicine is, you never know what you're going to be dealing with in those circumstances and in whatever country.
Well, and I would think that you don't know if you have everything that you need also, because it's not one injury at a time. Like you guys are, when you come under fire, many of you could be injured at the same time and trying to navigate multiple colleagues that are hurting and trying to prioritize their care, all while not being very medically trained. That's a lot of pressure.
It is. Now, I've been in situations where there were 10 guys that got hit by an IED. So immediately you're trying to sort through that. Special Forces medic is directing people who don't have any or very little training in tactical care, you know, and you're dealing with a wider range of injuries there. So it's pretty intense. You know, I've been in, you know, mass casualty events like that, or four, you know, you have four guys who have a truck pinned on them or on fire, and, you know, body parts are missing, got crawling out to you to kind of reaching their hands out to you and calling for you to help them. So really you're limited to what you have in your truck or in your backpack, you know. So it's not like a full suite of floor where you have people and you have the supplies and you know kind of what's coming through the door in years of experience, right, as a trained surgeon or a tech. So it's like, hey, grab that aid bag, start sorting this guy out, and by the way, I need you to kind of run through this gunfire to you know, with
So you were talking about the fact that you might have several guys and you have what's in your backpack or what's in the truck. In the meantime, you're trying to dodge bullets and get what you can get. That's multitasking at its finest or worst.
Indeed. And we just focus on the basics, ABCs, airway, blood, controlling that bleeding, and then circulation, and then doing your best to get that guy in a safe spot, get out of harm's way, wait for a medevac helicopter to come and get that patient to, you know, a field hospital somewhere else. So, which can be in itself quite a task, because sometimes it's too dangerous for an aircraft to come in and get these patients out to a field hospital. So you have folks who are just constantly monitoring, moving the casualty, reassessing them. Sometimes that happens for, you know, 12 hours or 18 hours or maybe just a few hours. So,
and then in those aspects, like, time is not your friend. You don't have hours sometimes.
You need that golden hour. That's what they call it, right? Yeah. The golden hour.
It's true. Yeah. Let's pivot, if you will, to you being a patient. You know, we surg techs make some of the worst patients out there. We hate going to surgery because we know what happens. We know everything that is going to, you know, every position we're about to be put in, every step the surgeon's going to make. And that can make us horrible patients. And so I would imagine, with your experience in explosives and understanding the intricacies of an IED, to then fall victim to one, what was that like in your head? Did you also just know too much about, you know, what you just went through?
I'll back up to 2008, being on patrol and being in a pretty intense ambush. You know, I took a round, and it was a pretty easy gunshot wound, some shrapnel kind of cleanup. And, you know, I looked at it and I was fine. Pushed through the ambush and then got medevaced shortly after that. So the helicopter came, took me back to Kandahar. I was fine. Talked to my boss, the commanding officer of the task force. And, you know, I begged him, said, "Hey, let me stay here." And he's like, "Hey, go down to Kandahar." I was with a forward surgical team right away. And they're like, "Hey, we'll get you taken care of, but we're going to send you to Kandahar." Went to Kandahar, got taken care of. No problems. You know, of course I called my wife, say, "Hey, I got hurt today, but I ain't going nowhere." So, which was not a good conversation to have. She was not happy.
Oh my God. My heart goes out to her so much.
But she understood, kind of, you know, so.
we're still your loved ones. Like, yeah, we might understand, but it's not something you still want to go through.
Exactly. I stayed and finished up that rotation in Afghanistan, came home, and kind of moved on with things. And then in 2012, I was on patrol. This time I'd become a chief warrant officer on an A team, and I was leading a patrol, and, you know, I stepped on an IED, and immediately I knew what had happened, you know, fully conscious during this thing. So I knew what happened, but where we were, I was like, okay, be ready for a follow-on ambush. You know, the typical guerrilla warfare stuff, or, you know, they put something out there where one guy gets hurt, three or four of his buddies come, then they light up the whole gang. So they're looking for multiple targets. Just running through what was happening in my mind, you know, find gun, can't find gun, find tourniquet, can't find tourniquet, stay awake. That's kind of the checklist. But this time I couldn't see. My eyes had kind of been, well, they had some corneal abrasions, couldn't see, missing body parts, burns, broken bones, pretty standard fun stuff. So once my buddy George came, he was the medic on the team, and my team sergeant Carlos came over, immediate sense of relief washed over me. I was like, okay, like, George is an incredible special forces medic guy. And so we just ran through it, and I just let him do his thing and tried to stay awake. It did come to a point though where the bleeding was so bad, I told George, like, "Hey man, like, I think this is it. Like, I'm trying so hard to stay awake, but, you know, like, it took a real hard turn really quick." So.
And I think maybe the corneal abrasion was a blessing. I think maybe if you could truly have seen what was going on, the fight to stay awake maybe would have been harder.
Yeah. You know, I never thought about it that way. All I knew was, and that's a great point. Yeah. I just, once he came over, I just put my head back in that little crater where I was laying in. I was like, "All right, do your stuff, man." So, and just tried to stay calm, but I could hear in his voice, you know, I've known George for a long time. We've done a lot of stuff together. I could tell in his voice that I wasn't in a good place. You know, as my job as a patient, I guess at that point in time, was to talk to him, just like we're chatting now, and to keep him calm, because, you know, I could tell, like, things aren't looking good. Even though I couldn't see it, I could sense that. that was my responsibility as a patient, I guess, at that point in time, was to stay awake and just keep them calm. And
I think that speaks so much to your character that you went into caregiver mode and were, you know, just as concerned for George as George was concerned for you, which I think also is a great illustration of how close you get when you're under high stress situations. My husband has friends that will go to the grave with him as being so incredibly close to him because of things that they experienced. So my hat off to you and to George in that situation.
Oh, thank you.
So what happened? They stabilized you or slowed the bleeding enough to get you out of that situation, and then you were helicoptered where?
Medevac came relatively quickly. We had an Air Black Hawk helicopter came, and we weren't too far from Kandahar Airfield. And so I think by helicopter, we were only, I want to say maybe 15 minutes away, something like that, or less. So they came, loaded me up, and took me to Kandahar Airfield. It's called the Roll 3, which is like their big military hospital there, like they're in Kandahar. So that's where I was, and that's where I stayed for a little bit until they can kind of get me stable and, you know, figure out what the next steps were. And then eventually, you know, the return to the States started really in Kandahar. So
did you go to Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany?
I did. I went from Kandahar, stayed there until they kind of get me sorted out to Bagram. Hit some bad weather. This was in November of 2012. And then finally made it out of Bagram and got to Landstuhl. And weather was pretty bad. So they were trying to time it where we can get out and safely get me to the States. So I stayed in Landstuhl for a few days.
So was that the end of your military career in active duty?
No, that was it is the tail end for sure. One, because I'd made a request to go to Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio at Fort Sam Houston. And so once I got to the States, they sent me to BAMC, they call it. And while at BAMC, immediately it was, you know, surgery after surgery. You know, I ended up having about 20, over 20 amputations to my left leg, which took me from just above the IED, took just really my foot off. But I was dealing with an unknown infection. They had never seen anything like it before. So they were trying to figure out what this infection was and how to stay ahead of it. So what the answer was to amputate. So it was constantly just amputating. And sometimes it would be every other day, every couple of days, or every day, like, hey, we have to stay ahead of this thing. We're trying really hard. Meantime, while my right leg was just completely blown open, a ton of soft tissue damage and all that kind of stuff. So, and then you had the infection, right? So the amputations, the infection, and all the soft tissue damage and stuff like that. So those guys were dealing with a lot with me, and I was just kind of laying there, you know, just trying to hang out. So trying to be a good patient, and there's really nothing you could do.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit as a patient. I think that, you know, you too are going through that. And I would think that obviously you are going through a massive mental or physical toll, but the mental toll, how did you handle it mentally? I know I worked at LRMC and we talked to a lot of guys that the physical changes that happen due to injury, they really do. It's hard. It's almost harder than the physical aspect in their recovery because it changes everything about your world, not just what happened on the battlefield.
At first, I was a little annoyed. I guess that's the best way to put it, because I was the commanding officer of my detachment at the time. We, you know, me and just a couple of Green Beret guys and some infantry guys that are attached to us. And so I felt a huge amount of disappointment of like, man, I'm away from the guys. You know, I was very grateful that no one else got hurt. It was just me. So I was very, very happy in that regard. But, you know, I was like, man, these guys are counting on me. I'm counting on these guys also to carry out the mission. So it was just disappointing for me, you know, like I couldn't finish the job I was sent there to do, like the mission there. So, but the guys, you know, they do what they do, and they were fine, and they finished out the tour. But for me, is my perspective. of all my rotations in and out of these countries, seeing guys, you know, ripped in half, or seeing guys who are just nothing's left of these people. Yeah. You know, I seeing those things, you know, I look at myself, well, when I could see, they told me I'd never see again because my eyes got beat up so bad. So when I could see, and I see what's going on, you know, I'm like, you know what, this really ain't too bad, all things considered, just because of my experiences, right? And that perspective I have on things. And for me, I was like, I'll figure it out. And I knew nothing about prosthetics, anything on that side of healthcare. But I knew there were some great Paralympic athletes out there who run around with as double amputees or single amputees or wheelchair sports. You know, I was like, I'll figure it out. This is probably a good time to be an amputee because the technology's there. So
the technology is phenomenal. Yeah. So how prosthetics, you know, what is that like for you ultimately once they fought the infection? Did they have to go above your knee or below?
The guy that did the majority of my surgeries, a guy called Don Gajewski, he was a colonel at the time. And he'd come in and tell me every time, like, hey, this is what we're going to do. And he said, we want to keep you below the knee. I was like, that's great. And he explained the differences. And then I remember he came in, he's like, hey, we have to go through the knee. He's like, that's okay. There's still some advantages there. Like, you'll be in good shape. And I was like, hey, that's fine too. It kind of kept my motivation up. And then he came into the door and I could tell it wasn't a good news. And he's like, hey, and he sat on my bed. He's like, hey, we have to go above the knee. And it took the wind out of my sails. I'm not going to lie to you.
Like, shit.
Yeah. And I was like, just keep me alive. That's what I told him. You know, I was like, just keep me alive. I'll figure out the rest. I mean, that's my approach to it. It's like, as long as I'm alive, I'll figure it out. That in itself, like, the gift of life is, you know,
it's precious.
It's precious. One leg, two legs, or whatever, it didn't matter to me at that point. You know, like, it really didn't matter at all. I just wanted to be alive. So, you know, so I could get to do things and go back to my job, take my kids to watch t-ball or play t-ball or whatever it is, you know. So I was like, just so mentally, I was like, just stay alive. Like, just listen to these guys when, you know, when they take you to surgery, understand what they're doing and appreciate what they're doing and do your best to recover, you know. So that was my approach to really being at BAMC. Just stay positive, trust these folks that they know what they're doing and are going to do the best, give me the best options to get discharged and get back to my regular life. So
I love that. And I think that as our audience is listening to this, I hope that they pick up on the amount of trust that you had for the team who was caring for you in the operating room. You know, you didn't know everyone that was in the OR. You didn't know all the players, but every single person in that OR had to be on their A game. They had to have perfect aseptic technique. They had to have complete focus on you as the patient in order for you to receive excellent care. And I hope they take away that blind trust that you had in that team to care for you so that you could be a dad and a husband and you could go on and continue to do great things in your career. I'm so grateful for your vulnerability and that trust, because it's important for us to remember it's not just a job.
Oh yeah, it's a huge, I appreciate that and thank you, but it made me realize and appreciate what a hospital is. You know, all my other stuff I dealt with, I was kind of like, yeah, I'm okay. I just got to get back. But you know, when you have folks wheeling you into the OR and they're taking off pieces of your body and they're doing their best to keep you alive. And it really was eye-opening to me. And it caused a great, great sense of appreciation and for what these strangers, people I don't know, who I'm entrusting to keep me alive and do something that's going to give me a better quality of life. And that's why I love doing what I do today. So,
well, let's transition to that. You know, you're recovering, you are healing, you're finally out of an operating room, thank God. What came next after that for you?
My recovery time after all my surgeries and amputations and PT and OT and all that stuff, it was about a 15-month ordeal, almost the 18 months of just being a patient. I decided to, I went back to my unit and told them I would like to retire, and they were supportive of whatever decision I wanted to do. So I went, packed my bags, became a retiree and looked for the next thing in life. And I had some things going on career-wise, and it was good, non-medically related and kind of aerospace stuff. And, you know, I was happy, but not too thrilled about what I was doing. I mean, it was a good time. I learned a lot. But, and then I moved back to the San Antonio region and was looking for something to do. And I'd bought a little ranchito and started raising honeybees and just.
Wait a minute. Nobody thinks of ranch and then thinks immediately honeybee.
Well, it was the first step, like being a bee rancher. So it was easy. My wife wanted honeybees. So that means I wanted honeybees, so that was the first thing, that I had going on there. And then, just looking to kind of enjoy life a little bit. And I lo and behold, I get a call from a random guy who says, "Hey, you should come work at Apiary Medical and sell stuff to hospitals and be there to take care of providers." And I'm like, "Okay, I guess."
So I love your ability to say yes. And I have to ask you a question, because trauma scrub transplants, like, my brain works when I'm in an adrenaline filled situation. And then I transition to education, which education is stressful some days, but that you don't get that adrenaline spike like you do when, the gun and knife show is fully active in your operating room. And so special forces, there's that adrenaline spike and it's almost addictive. Like, how do you transition from craving that almost to civilian life and raising honeybees? How in the world did that happen?
I think it's just acceptance. I knew, yeah. I'm like, okay, that part of my life is over. That chapter of my life is over. And I'm okay with that. I had a great run, did some amazing things, served with some like real heroes. And yeah. it's time for me to move on. And I was okay with that.
So you were just, no regrets. Like, you didn't have any regrets from trying out for special forces. You made it. No regrets for your deployments. No regrets as a patient. And now you're a civilian and you're going to embrace that no regrets outlook now.
Exactly. And sometimes, like, I'm not going to lie, like, when, I don't know what was worse, being in a gunfight or opening up a beehive where there's like 30,000, 50,000 bees that are trying to rip your face off. So I was like, I wish I was in Afghanistan, because this is not enjoyable. But
who knew that was going to prepare you?
But yeah, it's really just, and part of it is too, is I look back at, again, like a moment of perspective for me is every single one in that OR, really in that hospital, from the people who kept those instruments sterilized and prepped and ready, to the surgeon who's using them, to the guy that was pushing me out the door in a wheelchair to take me to PT. I didn't want their efforts to be in vain. To me, that, I was, man, like, those guys did everything. Those people did everything they could and to keep me alive. And for me to sit here and cry about it and moan about it, and especially, those guys who didn't make it back home, man, that's like a slap in the face to every single one of those people. To me,
I was so, like, embrace the hell out
of it. You just got to embrace it and just live a good life, so.
I want to talk more about apiary surgical instruments and all that you all do, but you said some random guy just hit you up, but like literally the business grant that you all are operating under is specific to service members. So talk about that and the opportunities it's given, because you guys, you're all veterans of our armed forces, correct?
Yeah. So Apiary Medical is a service disabled veteran owned small business. The majority of us are veterans or spouses of veterans or first responders. So our boss, the CEO, Chris Hatzel, he's a combat wounded Marine, got put out of the Marine Corps after being hit by an IED in Iraq, and really kind of started his journey trying to find out what he wanted to do, and which, he spent a lot of time in the healthcare space. And then he had this great idea of like, man, I need to get a company and I need to hire veterans and we need to get in there and serve the VAs and the Department of Defense military treatment facilities, and we need to do our part to take care of, you know, those who take care of our veterans, our family members, and our service members today. So, and that's how Apiarian Medical came about. And it's a company that's been around since 2004, but Chris had acquired the company in 2019. And he's done a great job of hiring veterans. Veterans like me with no experience in medical space and getting them trained and sent out the door and engaging, you know, how to engage with the ORs, how to engage with hospital leaders, and letting them know that we're there to give them the best things that they can get to better do their jobs and get those patients on and off the table without any issues and out the door to a better life. So
what was it about this opportunity that sparked your interest?
I went up there to Denver. This is where we used to be headquarters out of. So I went to Denver and I listened to Chris talk and I wasn't really sure. I'm not gonna lie. I was like, man, I don't know. This is kind of, I don't know if I belong here. And then I got back to San Antonio and, you know, I talked to my wife and I really thought about it on the plane right home. And again, I just use my personal experience of everyone, like I said, the logistics guy to the sterile processing department to the guy pushing me out the door. And I was like, man, those people did a lot to keep me here. They used their talents to keep me alive. And it's like, if there's some way I can give back to a hospital, this is what I should be doing because it's so meaningful. These people didn't know me. They put everything in, you know, out there to keep me here. So,
oh my God, my heart. I'm not going to cry during this daggum episode. So as somebody who wasn't medically trained, I probably know the names of like 4,000 instruments at this point, and every instrument's got like 4 different names and it's all regional. So you might go to the Northeast and they call it a schnit. You might come to the Southwest and they call it a tonsil. You know, it can't just be a stupid pair of scissors, right? We've got to have 100 different ways to say it. Does that bring back memories from when you were in school and trying to learn about IEDs and all of the components for explosives?
Well, it's exactly the same thing. You know, there's different components and I mean, it's all foreign to me. I guess as a new student to this profession, Chris Hatzell gave me a book of instruments. He's like, hey, you should probably read this. Cause all I knew was like a scissors and butter knife and a steak knife. That was like, as far as, you know, and mosquito forceps, like that's all I knew about this stuff. So, but it was the passion. Yeah, I was like, you know, I want to be here. I want to make a difference. I want to be able to give these providers the best things that they can get their hands on. It was just reading yeah. And educating. And there's so many ways to get educated today that are widely available. It's just researching, asking questions. I would call folks on a team, say, hey, like, what does this mean? Like, how do I do this? And kind of what's the best way to talk about these things? And, you know, being on a great team, it's like guys were more than willing to help.
What does a day in the life look like now?
It's a lot different than the old days. I started off as a 1099 salesman, so knocking on the doors of the VAs, trying to sell them some stuff, you know, some surgical instruments, and working with SPD guys. But now I'm on the ops team, so I run the operations. So it's a lot of coordinating with folks in the field, coordinating amongst, you know, with our general manager and make sure that things are going well and just kind of doing our day-to-day stuff and some near-term and long-term planning, just trying to run the business, keep the business running strong. So, but I do like to get out and interact with the sterile processing teams. I miss that part of it. So it is nice to get out there and chat with those folks and occasionally get out and cover down on a case somewhere. So I really enjoy talking to those folks and, you know, of course they're curious to hear my story and it really is nice to get out in the field.
I think our sterile processing technicians across the country don't get enough credit. They're not in the operating room, but it does not matter how well we do or adhere to a sepsis in the operating room. If they don't do their job in the first place, all of that's for naught. And I think that they are behind the scenes and considered, you know, I think too often they're just considered support roles, which is just so far from the truth. But our sterile processors really do need a shout out for the amount of expertise they have in their career field and how important their job is to us in the operating room.
Oh, absolutely. We went to the HSPA show out in San Antonio last year, or the last show was in San Antonio. And like, it was great to see these people out of the basement, you know, of a facility somewhere, and just to be able to interact with these folks. And especially for me, going around, they come to our booth and we chat a little bit, and immediately I'm like, man, you guys are some of the real heroes in the hospital, because without you guys, the techs, and doing what they do in the sterile processing world, like, nothing else matters.
Nothing else matters.
Because, and they're the unsung heroes. They don't get the recognition or the credit they deserve. You know, again, you talk about military movies and kind of like, is this real? Like, is this what you guys do? It's kind of like being in a medical scene in a movie or a show where there's like a surgeon, he's all bloodied up and he's like, we got him. Like, he's going to survive. You know, and everyone's like, yeah. And then you got the sterile processing folks who are like, yeah, it's because of us. You know, like, there's a huge part of the play. You know, like,
he's not going to die from an infection because we did our job.
It's interesting, like, the living in the shadows. And it's kind of like, it's kind of like being a special operation. Like, you don't get, you know, there's a lot of things we do that don't get recognition that people will never hear about or they don't think about, but we are the ones making it happen. And like, sterile processing, those people are in the shadows of a basement somewhere in a hospital, sterilizing, prepping, packing, and they send it forward, and you know,
and they get no credit either. Yeah, it's like Santa Claus in his workshop, right? That's what everybody says. We're just elves moving along. And I think there are a lot of surgical technologists out there that can relate to that too, because nobody knows who we are. Like, nobody knows. Everyone assumes it's the nurse and the physician who get all the credit, and it's always those behind the scenes players who are integral to the care the patient receives, yet don't get a thank you, or don't, the patient themselves might not even understand who was in the room or the role that they were playing in. That, I think that adds to the nobility of the profession, and just that you have to find ways to have satisfaction without somebody giving you an attaboy. And you also have that in special forces. So I would imagine all of those things correlate to your experience daily now.
Yeah, it's a pretty unique career field, the folks in the sterile processing realm. And it's overworked, underappreciated. So my hat's off to, you know, my hat's off, you know, to all the folks everywhere that do that. You know, you're not forgotten. Like, you guys are the real heroes. So
in your role now in doing logistics, do you feel like you brought a lot of those skill sets that you learned on the field and downrange as a team lead? Do you use that kind of mentorship for your team now?
Yeah, every day. You know, people look towards, you know, look for leadership and guidance. But on the back end of that too, I look to these folks, my teammates, every single day for guidance and leadership, because their experience they bring, you know, my experience comes from something completely different outside of the healthcare realm. But I think we can both agree that the leadership of principle, I mean, the principles of leadership are there no matter what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, relying on, you know, it's like that, what you just said, it's, you have these teams, these sterile processing teams that don't get the credit they deserve, but you have good leaders to reassure that and show them appreciation, and constantly, I imagine, reinforcing the fact that, hey, we made a difference today. And that's what drives people to come to work and do what they do every single day, and just kind of lead from the front. And obviously the folks in the OR being a good representative, being that good liaison between the OR and the sterile processing, there's leadership there. There's, you know, maintaining that relationship is pretty important too, because both depend on each other heavily.
I totally agree. I think we're super segmented in the field of medicine, and the only way forward isn't just technology, isn't just new procedural approaches. Ultimately, it's all of us having a deep appreciation and respect for the different allied health professions and how we all play a massive role in making sure that our patients are cared for the way I'd want my family cared for and the way that you would want your family cared for.
100%. Absolutely.
Daniel, first of all, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to you. Thank you to your wife. Thank you to your children. Thank you for your service to our country. I can truly say that I understand the sacrifices. In some ways, I'm grateful that my husband was never injured, but I had the privilege of working at Landstuhl and seeing those of you who made the ultimate sacrifice and lost, you know, your friends and family on the field. I'm so grateful for your drive and your determination to stay alive. I'm also grateful for your trust in all of us in the operating room and ensuring that, you know, we would care for you the way you deserved. So thank you for sharing your story today. Thank you for your service to our country. Thank you for what you continue to do for the field of surgery. I want to leave you with the last words, like those who are listening to this podcast. What is it that you want them to take away from your story today?
Well, thank you for everything you just said there. And thank you back to you and your family for wearing a uniform for a lot of years and making the sacrifices that come with that commitment. So thank you to you and your husband and your family. And then, you know, if there's one thing I guess I could leave with the listeners is just don't take anything for granted. Don't take life for granted and do the little things and spend the time with your loved ones, because we don't know when that time will be taken away from us. So just realize how precious life is and try to enjoy it. Enjoy each other and treat each other well and just never take things for granted. I guess that's what I'll say.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for everything that you do and continue to do. And you have a military family, but you also have those of us who are in the medical field wrapping our arms around you all too. And thank you to your colleagues at Apiary. And we're grateful for all that you do for our veterans. And we can't wait to see what comes next.
Awesome. And thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Scrub Life podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. We can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at the Scrub Life podcast. Show notes for this episode, as well as past episodes, our contact information, and the virtual suggestion box can be found at our webpage, thescrublifepodcast.com. This has been Chris Blevins and Stephanie Austin with the Scrub Life Podcast. Until next time, be safe, support each other, and stay sterile.